Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know.
You just said this.
This is where we came in. Is this a trick?
It's kind of a Twilight Zone experience. You can find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Doug Sovereign of KCBS Radio here in San Francisco, your moderator this evening. This program is part of the Commonwealth Club's Good Lit series, underwritten by the Bernard Osher Foundation. And now it's my pleasure to introduce our special guests today, Dave Barry and Alan Zweibel, humorists and authors of the new book, Lunatics. They need no introduction. I'm going to give them one anyway. Dave Barry won the Pulitzer Prize for his insightful and very funny columns in the Miami Herald, which he wrote for 21 years. Not each column, but all of them in the aggregate, 21 years. He's also the best-selling author of more than 30 books, none of which has won the Pulitzer Prize, but Lunatics could be the one. You may remember the TV series Dave's World, which was based on his life. Fortunately for us, his life is running a lot longer than the TV show. Dave is now the co-author of Lunatics, which he has written with Alan Zweibel. Alan was one of the original staff writers and performers on Saturday Night Live, starting way back in 1975. He has written 6 books, 2 Broadway shows, numerous movies, and has won more awards than we could possibly mention here. Please welcome Dave Barry and Alan Zweibel.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Doug, for that fairly lengthy introduction. Yeah. I'm going to go first. I'm Dave, first of all, we're thrilled to be here at the Commonwealth Club. We thought we'd both tell you a little bit about ourselves beyond what Doug said. I live in Miami. I moved there in 1986 from the United States. And one of the things I always feel I should defend my city because it has a bad reputation. Has a bad image. Every year the Zogby organization does this poll where they ask people what they think of major cities, and every year Miami does very poorly in that poll. The last one, 67% of the respondents said they thought Miami is a dangerous, violent place, and that hurts. We see that. We want to track those people down and kill them because it's a wonderful city. It really is. And it's just a question of learning to adapt to the local culture. And if you go, for example, you would never say out loud in Miami, I don't know, I think you have to admit Castro has done some good for Cuba. But anyway, whatever you've heard, disregard, it's a great town. We have a new attitude down there, new tourism promotion slogan. Come back to Miami, we weren't shooting at you. Now, I'm going to tell you quickly about my career because it's going to lead up to Alan, but I've been a humor writer most of my life. I started out as a real reporter, a regular reporter. I worked at a little paper in Pennsylvania called the Daily Local News in Westchester, Pennsylvania. Very small town paper, not maybe the best edited paper in the world. We once, this is true, ran a headline that said, "Woman beats off would-be rapist." But that's where I got my start in journalism, and I was not great at the report. I was an English major, and I really went into journalism because I wanted to write, but I quickly learned that writing is not the key skill in journalism. Talking to people is the key skill in journalism, and sometimes you have to talk to people who are intimidating or hostile. Good reporters are able to do that and keep their train of thought and not get flustered, and I was not good at that part. I'm just going to give you one anecdote. This is true. It was after I became a columnist but was still dealing with news events. In 1992, I was in New Hampshire writing columns about the New Hampshire presidential primary, and I spent a day following then-First Lady Barbara Bush around, not as a stalker but as a member of the press corps with the First Lady. And it was a big press corps, lots of people, and a whole motorcade of us going around and all these dignitaries and went to the various events. At the end of the day, Mrs. Bush had a press conference and it was a hotel ballroom with a big stage, and the place was packed. And I didn't ask any questions. I'm just writing, taking notes for my little humor column. And then when I thought it was all over, the photographer brought the press corps that had been with Mrs. Bush up onto, so maybe two dozen of us, brought us onto the stage and formed us in a semicircle and put me right next to Barbara Bush, First Lady of the United States, for this picture. And that's a situation where I know in my mind to say nothing. I knew that in my mind. Well, you know, your brain does not always tell the rest of your body what the plan is. And so we're standing in front of all of this kind of quiet moment with all these high-powered journalists and this room full of people. And I plan to say nothing, but for some reason, my mouth came open. And I said to Barbara Bush, First Lady of the United States, who I've never met, she had no idea who I am. I said, I shop at the same supermarket as your son, Jeb. I swear to you that's what I said. And it was true at the time. I did shop at the same, this is before he became governor of Florida. I shopped same supermarket as Jeb Bush, but I'm sure, I mean, I don't think the First Lady was dying to know that. You know, I don't think she's standing there going, hey, I wonder if this fella shops at any supermarkets with me. But I inform her of that fascinating fact, and she goes, well, who gives a shit? Not with her mouth, but with her eyes. She made, with her mouth, she said, we just celebrated Jeb's 39th birthday. Now, if you analyze these two statements, I shop the same supermarket as Jeb, they have nothing to do with each other. She was being gracious. You know, she's probably seen this happen a million times. The person in front of her has been reduced to a blithering idiot because she's Barbara Bush. And, you know, rather than point out what an inane statement I had made, she was pretending we were having a conversation about her son. We really weren't, but she was bailing me out. It was very thoughtful of her to do that. And I knew she was doing that. I'm thinking like, oh, I can't believe I said, thank you, Mrs. Bush. That's what I'm thinking with my mind. Then I look down and I see to my horror that my mouth is thinking, whoa, we are really hitting it off here. And I hear myself say to Barbara Bush, the First Lady of the United States, following up on the fascinating fact that I shopped the same supermarket as her son, Jeb, I said, he's very tall. I swear. And it's true, Jeb Bush is a tall individual, but I'm sure the First Lady was already aware of that fact. You know, so now she's looking around for the guy with the tranquilizer dart gun, you know. And she said, well, he didn't just grow this year. And then, thank God, this is all true. The guard took the picture and it was over, except I had to endure the ridicule of my fellow journalists on the long bus ride back to the hotel, marveling at my interviewing technique. Speculating on what I would have asked Lee Harvey Oswald if I had the opportunity. You know how they say this phenomenon called spontaneous human combustion, where people just burst into flames and scientists can't explain why. I can explain why. Sometimes that is your best option. So that really is how I became a humor writer. I was really not good at the journalism side. All my life I've been just writing humor. And I mostly wrote it on my own. And then I ran into, and I met again Ridley Pierce, and I'm in the band with Ridley Pierce and the Rock Bottom Remainers, and we ended up writing some young adult fiction books together, and I enjoyed that experience, and but I never would have thought of writing an adult type novel with anybody else until I met Alan. And I'm just going to tell you real quick about Alan, because I really don't know if you realize how kind of major he has been in the comedy world. How many of you remember that really the 75 to 80 Saturday Night Lives? Yeah, okay. That's, a lot of that was this man here. How many of you have seen 700 Sundays? Billy Crystal. Mm-hmm. Fantastic play. Won a Tony. Alan Zweibel co-wrote that with Billy Crystal. How many of you have heard the song Mr. Bojangles? Okay, he had nothing to do. At all. He's not really good at music at all, but you can't have everything, can you? So anyway, ladies and gentlemen, my co-writer, and I ask one thing of you when we get to the questions, please, no questions or comments about the freakishly huge size of his head. Okay? That's all we ask. In fact, we would be happy if you don't even look at it right now.
Not that big.
It's a huge, huge head. It's kind of like it's like Easter Island for our radio.
It's for our radio audience, yes.
But in fact, Doug and I are kind of leaning to our left just because of the gravitational force. But as they say, he's sensitive about it, and So please just know, don't even, let's forget right now about Alan Zweibel's head. Ladies and gentlemen, Alan Zweibel.
You know, it's really amazing to me that I actually know Dave Barry and actually wrote a book with him. It's like, I remember as either 5 or 6 year old kid, my grandfather used to read a lot of Dave's stories to me. And here I am now, you know. How did I become a humor writer? Well, it's ironic. The whole thing is because originally it was not my idea to become a comedy writer. This was a decision that was made for me about 35 years ago by every law school in the United States. I went to college. My grade point average was really good, but you had to take the law boards, which was graded from 200 to 800. If you can write your name, you got a 200. If you were Einstein, you got an 800. If you were Alan Zweibel, you got a 390, which reclassified me as mineral. Okay. So I remember going home, I think it was like Easter or so, vacation. I told my parents that I got a Long Island Jewish parents that I got a 390 on the law boards. And about a week later, this is after they uncovered the mirrors. My father gave me $1,000, which I then took and gave to a man named Stanley Kaplan. For those of you not familiar with him, Stanley Kaplan's got these schools all over the country where they teach you how to take standardized tests. So I gave him the $1,000, and for 6 months, I studied to retake the law boards. I had the number 2 pencils. I had the things on my ears. I just really was studious about it. 6 months later, I retook the test, and my score catapulted up to a 401. So I figured at that rate, I'd be about 90 before I got into an English-speaking law school. So I started writing jokes for old comedians who played in the Borscht Belt, the Catskill section of New York, those hotels. They paid me $7 a joke. That was the going rate at the time. I'm 21. They're 45. It was like writing for my parents' friends, but I tried my best. And they'd say to me, like, Alan, sperm banks. Sperm banks are in the news. Write me sperm bank jokes. 21. This is what was really foremost on my mind. So I'd write a joke. Like they have this new thing now called sperm banks, which is just like an ordinary bank, except here, if you make a deposit, you lose interest. Hey, $7, what do you want? So then I became the sperm bank guy, you know, go, more sperm bank jokes. So I looked into the future and I said, you know something? I see a problem with these sperm banks. They were starting to freeze sperm. I said, that's going to be a problem in the future because it's hard enough telling a kid he's been adopted. How do you tell me he's been defrosted? $7, okay? I'm living home with my parents. This is after college. I got a job in a delicatessen to supplement this great living that I was making. My price went to $10, then $12. These were all nondescript comedians I was writing for. And I was going nowhere fast because none of them had a distinct personality. Years later, it was easier to write for guys who had characters like Rodney Dangerfield. He had the thing, I don't get no respect. So it was really easy to have him say, I never got any respect, even as an infant. My mother wouldn't breastfeed me. She said she liked me as a friend. You see, that was easy. And you know, the Catskills were dying, and I'm going, okay, I'm going to live with my parents forever. I'm going to work in this deli forever. So I took all the jokes these old guys wouldn't buy from me, and I made it into a stand-up routine for myself. There were 2 clubs in New York City. This is the mid-70s, one called Catch a Rising Star, another one called The Improvisation. I would go on stage. This was my plan. Deliver the jokes, and maybe a manager or an agent the kind of people who used to hang out there would like my material and give me a job, because this is where, you know, David Brenner started and Richard Pryor and Bette Midler and Lily Tomlin. So the first week that I'm working there, I met a guy who was also starting out. His name was Billy Crystal. He lived about three towns over from where my parents lived. And he had a little blue Volkswagen. He used to pick me up every single night. We'd drive into the city. We'd get on stage, do our jokes. He'd drive me home, and we would critique each other's jokes and our acts. And I'm about 4 months into this nightmare, into this experiment of mine. And it's one night about 1 o'clock in the morning. I'm having the hardest time in the world making these four drunks from Des Moines laugh. I get off the stage, I go to the bar, and I'm waiting for Billy to come off to give me a ride home. And a guy comes up to me, he sits down next to me, and just starts staring at me and staring at me. And finally I go, what? What do you want? He goes, you know, you're the worst comedian I've ever seen in my life. I said, thank you. I really need to hear this right now. Thank you very much. He said, but your material is good. Did you write it? And I said, yeah. He said, well, can I see more of it? I went, you bet. I mean, I didn't even ask his name. I would have shown it to like a gardener at this point. Ends up this guy is Lorne Michaels. And he's gone from club to club in New York looking for writers and actors for this new show to be called Saturday Night Live that was going to premiere in the fall. I go back to my parents' house in Long Island. I sit down at my mom and dad's kitchen table, and I type up what I believe were 1,100 of my best jokes. 2 days later, I have to go back to the city for my meeting with Lorne, and I was so nervous. What should I wear? What should I wear? Well, hip new show, hip producer. Oh, I'll dress hip. I put on my father's maroon polyester leisure suit. I look like a big blood clot sitting on the Long Island Railroad. I went to the city. He was staying at the Plaza Hotel. My meeting was like at 2 o'clock. I didn't want to be late. I was really nervous. So I got there like at 7 in the morning. And I see a payphone. It's 75. There's no cell phones. I go to a payphone. I call Billy Crystal, who had been talking to Lorne about the possibility of Billy being on this new show. I said, listen, I got a meeting with Lorne. Any hints you can give me so I can have like a leg up in this meeting? He says, well, he used to write for Woody Allen. He's produced Monty Python specials. Oh, and he hates mimes. Lorne hates mimes. I went, gotcha. I go upstairs. I sit on the edge of the bed. He pulls up a chair. And I give him this tome with 1,100 jokes in it. And he opens it. And he reads the first joke. And he goes, uh-huh. Good. And then he closes the book. I'm up for 2 days. I'm typing 1,100 jokes. He reads one joke. And just to show you how long ago this was from the reference points, I had written a joke saying that the post office was about to issue a stamp commemorating prostitution in the United States. 10-cent stamp. If you want to lick it, it's a quarter. He said, good, good. He said, tell me, how much money do you need to live on? I said, well, I'm making $2.75 an hour at the deli. Match it. And he said, well, tell me a little bit more about yourself, which I took to mean before he committed to this kind of cash, he wanted to see what he was buying. So I said, well, Woody Allen's my idol. Love Monty Python. But if there's one fucking mime on this show, I am out of here. And he gave me a job. So that was my break. And that's how I became a TV writer. And I guess we'll get into all of it. But ultimately, here I am, having written a novel with my childhood hero, Dave Barrett.
Dave Barry and Alan Zweibel. They're not here all week, folks. They're just here for the hour. We're going to talk a bit now and take some questions from you, the audience. We have written questions, and the cards are coming up if you have a question. And a bit later, we'll take some out loud as well. This book, Lunatics, I'm wondering, first of all, how did you guys decide to write this book together? Did one of you owe the other money? Did you lose a bet? How did this happen?
We were both at... We met in Washington, D.C. at when Steve Martin, in 2005 or 2006,
something like that, yeah.
He won the Mark Twain Award, and they have a big show, and we were both involved. I was one of the presenters. Alan was a waiter. So we had... No.
The deli experience.
Yeah. He had... just now getting that
chill,
joke.
So.
Anyway, no, Alan was a writer.
I helped Larry David write his speech.
He helped Larry David write his speech. When we're far away from Larry David, he says he wrote Larry David's speech, but we're still in California.
L.A., you know.
Yeah. Anyway, so we liked each other. We became sort of friends, and we saw each other off and on over the next few years at writers' conferences and stuff like that. And Alan kept saying...
We should do something together.
Which I didn't know what he meant.
You thought he meant.
I don't know what he meant. You know, yeah. No, he's very vague because it's like he's kind of in the film TV world where people always are saying they want to do something, and I got to go. Sure, let's do something together. But I didn't think we would. But then he had this idea.
His daughter Sophie plays soccer. She's 11 years old. I have three children, all of whom played organized sports, soccer, little league, and whatever. So I figured, okay, this is a common denominator. We had to figure out, because he lives 1,500 miles away from me. I'm in New Jersey. He's down in Coral Gables, Florida. I can give you his home number later if you wish. And I said, listen, all right, why don't we make it work for us? Let's have a situation. We came up with the situation where there's a championship game, girls who are 12 and under. The ref calls a 10-year-old girl offside when she kicks what would be the winning goal in the championship game. Her father goes ballistic. Let's have a feud between the ref and the father. I'll be the ref, you'll be the voice of the father, and we'll alternate chapters. And that's exactly what he did. My guy is the ref. His name is Philip Horkman. I wrote the first chapter, and I sent it to Dave, having no idea what he was going to send back to me.
And my guy is, his guy is a lot like him. He's a very sweet, wonderful man. Philip Hork. No, really, Alan's a gentle, you know, kind of gentle soul with just a huge head. And tell him what your guy, Philip Horkman, does for a living. Because it's key in the plot.
He owns a pet store.
Called?
The Wine Shop.
Because
he needed money to open it a few years ago. He asked his in-laws, whose last name was Wine, and they said, sure, we'll give you the money as long as our name is in the title of the store. So people stop into the store thinking they can get Merlot or Burgundy or whatever, and they're a little surprised to see salamanders, iguanas, and birds.
Lemurs.
Wow. So my guy's named Jeffrey Peckerman, and he is a horrible human being. He's racist, homophobic, just disgusting, coward. Nothing like me. It was a lot of work involved in creating this character. And he's the dad of the girl that his character calls offsides on. And they have a confrontation, which his guy thinks is nothing. To my guy, it's not nothing. It's horrible. But they don't like each other. A little confrontation, but they don't expect to ever see each other again. The next day, my guy is driving home from his job. He's a forensic plumber, which is a real job. This is a real job. Google this job if you don't believe me. If a crime is committed involving, let's say, a toilet, you would call a forensic plumber who would testify before that, like, the victims could not, with his head in the bowl, have reached the lever on that particular model of commode, so it couldn't have been a suicide. That is the kind of expert test. No, I'm not. Google it. I'm telling you, folks. Anyway, he is coming home from his job as a forensic plumber, and his wife tells him that she needs him to pick up some wine for her woman's book group. So he pulls into what the store he's never seen before called the wine shop. And that's, so they come back together. And that sets off this chain of events where they hate each other. They don't want to see each other again, but they keep getting pushed together randomly so that within a matter of days, without intending to, they have hijacked a clothing optional cruise ship.
It gets a little weird starting there. Yeah, okay? That's up to there.
That's very early in the plot that happens. And then from there, they end up... This is a story of two guys who don't want to be together. All they want to do is get home. That things keep happening to them. They never intend for any of these things to happen. But they become wanted international terrorists, and they become much more than that. They end up going all over the world.
They bring democracy to Cuba. They deliver 2 million bananas to the starving folks in Somalia. And so they go from being these perceived as terrorists to great liberators.
But they never know. This is never clear to them. They have no idea that any of this is happening all the way through. So that's sort of how we got going. And just one other thing, like a lot of times when people write books, novels, they have, and this is, I don't want to get too inside baseball, they have what's called a plot. We didn't really have that. We had the improvisational novel writing where neither one of us knew what the other one was going to send, and the rule was you couldn't change it. You just had to go with it. So our motive, more than like, you know, character arc development, our motive was almost entirely revenge. Like, oh, that's okay, I see what you gave me here, Mr. Funny Man. Let's see you deal with this, you know. That's how
it was like having a deranged pen pal, okay? Ted Kaczynski was writing to me, okay? I'd go to my inbox, I see that he wrote his chapter and sent it to me. I, having no knowledge whatsoever how he would have reacted to what I had just sent him a few days before. Okay? Our only goal was to react and to advance the
plot,
quote unquote,
plot.
Yes, okay? And I'd read it and I'd go, oh man, what am I gonna do with this? And I'd let it sink in, and about a day later I go, All right, I'll show him. And so I write something, and generally I got to a point in my chapter. The chapters are only about 3-4 pages long. We didn't want to get lost too much in one guy's story. We wanted to keep on going back and forth. I'd get to a point where I don't know how to get them out of this situation. I go, let him figure it out, and I send it to him.
Revenge. And meanwhile, what was kind of the weird part for me is I'm used to, like, you finish it before you show it to anybody. This is Mr., you know, collaborative medium person, and like after he writes like the first sentence, which is "What a wonderful day," and he sends it to Billy Crystal, and then he sends me an email. Billy loves the first sentence.
Listen, I was just taking the temperature of how this was going. He liked the first sentence, so I go, all right, but I'm going to write another sentence.
Not too much of exaggeration. We've written maybe like it's 3 or 4 chapters. We don't have any contract or anything. We really don't know if we have anything. And he's sending me these emails going like, the people I'm sending it to really love it. Steve Carell really loves it. You know what I mean? I mean, loves what? We have no book yet. So that's the way he thinks.
But it worked out. I mean, we already have a movie deal with Steve Carell attached to play Philip Hawkman, my character. So, it sort of worked.
Yeah, apparently.
Is it painful to have him attached, and is he easily removed, or is that something you... Sorry. All right. You're listening to the Commonwealth
Club. I just want to stress that... That was your joke.
Yes, it was. Okay. That is not in the book. No. And I must remind our audience that you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our guests are humorists Dave Barry and Ellen Zweibel. I'm Doug Sovereign. I'm just along for the ride. You answered about 10 questions there that people have submitted here, but one of them about the movie, Steve Carell. As I'm reading this book, I picture Steve Carell as the Horkman character. Do we have any idea? Actually, as I'm reading it, I was alternating between Steve Carell and you, but I had a hard time picturing Dave Barry as Peckerman. So who do we think is going to play? Any idea who will play Peckerman in the movie?
Duh. Well,
who would you like to see play?
Brad Pitt.
I knew that was your answer.
Thank God it's radio, huh?
I assume.
No, I don't know. It would have to be. He's the one. Alan's the one who's.
He's the movie guy.
The film guy.
The film guy. I just hope this one goes a little bit better than the last time I had a book that was made into a movie.
Will you tell him? I'm not sure that I want to be connected with a film, an Alan Zweibel film.
North?
Oh!
A number of years ago, our son, Adam, was about 7 years old. And he was at that age where, at the dinner table, he would look across at me and my wife, Robin, and just from the expression on his face, you can tell what he was thinking, like, I could do better than these two, you know? So I thought, all right. So I wrote this little novella. It was a fable about a 9-year-old boy named North who declared himself a free agent from his parents and went all over the world offering his services as a son to the highest bidding moms and dads. The novella did okay, but I sent it to Rob Reiner just for a blurb for the book jacket. He called me up. He said, you know, I'm a director now. He had done Stand By Me and When Harry Met Sally, A Few Good Men. He says, let's make this into a movie. It's the greatest thing a writer wants to hear. You wrote a book, and now you're asked to convert it into a screenplay to be a movie. Oh, it was the greatest time of my life. And I wrote a screenplay, and we cast it. It was Bruce Willis, Elijah Wood, Julia Louis-Dreyfus, Jason Alexander, my old friend Dan Aykroyd. It was a $50 million movie, and it was this big to-do with a big premiere in Hollywood. I flew my parents out from Florida, and it was the greatest night of my life. And then the next morning, the reviews came out. Now, I don't know how many of you remember Roger Ebert's review of North. Or carry it with you in your wallet.
To keep you humble.
But just to refresh your memory, I hated this movie. Hated this movie. Hated it. Hated every simpering, stupid, vacant, audience-insulting moment of it. Hated the sensibility that thought anyone would like it. Hated the implied insult to the audience by its belief that anyone would actually be entertained by it. Now, on the surface, this may seem like an unfavorable review, but if you read between the lines, I think he sort of liked it. And so I'm just hoping this one goes a little bit better, that's all.
Although it's Hollywood, you know, so we're already dealing with, we have these conversations with the people that have bought the rights, and the way it works now is they buy a book that's, you know, they tell you they love it and they buy it, and in the instant that they've bought it, they tell you all the things they hate about it and need to change. So we're in like preliminary talks, but it appears now it's going to end up being a story about a horse in World War I.
Alan, there's a number of questions here from people who would like to know more about the heyday of Saturday Night Live, and if there's any stories you want to share about anyone or anything, and what do you think of it today? Do you think it's funny today? Do you watch it still?
Okay, which do I answer first?
That's a compound fracture.
Back in the days that I was there, it was really exciting. We were all 22, 23 years old. It was our first jobs in TV, and the only rule that Lorne had for us was to make each other laugh. If we can make each other laugh, then we put it on TV, and it was so much fun. It was, you know, live. It was so vital and vibrant. Today I write novels, I write plays, and if I'm lucky, it comes out 2 years from now. But then I would write something on Monday, it would be on television. Millions of people would see it on Saturday. I can write something Saturday, they would see it that night. It was that immediate. There's a dress rehearsal audience at 7:30 on Saturday night. They come to the studio and they see everybody acting. They're in full costume. The band is playing. They see a show. Between dress and air, we rewrite everything. And then another audience comes in for the live show at 11:30. I would go upstairs between the two shows, and if something on the news struck me as funny, I would write it and put it on Weekend Update. It would be on a half hour later. I was with that show, and there were two times when they were actually on the air that I was under the update desk and handing up jokes that I had written for them. So it was just so immediate. As far as what I think of it today is concerned, I think it's really good. I think Seth Meyers and Kristen Wiig and Fred Armisen could have been in any cast in any era. So, you know, it's a show that's been on the air for 37 years or so. So it's going to have peaks and valleys as people leave and they reconstitute the writing staff and the cast. But I think that every time you think it's over, you know, John Lovitz comes along, Adam Sandler comes along, Tina Fey comes along. So I think that they're on a real high right now.
For Dave, the most common question I have here from the audience for you, if your hair could speak, what would it say?
Dave, it would say, Dave, the 60s are over.
I get a lot of crap for my hair. I mean, it's not quite as much as Alan gets for his head. But I don't know what I'm supposed to do. You know, this is the way it is. It just is this way. And I've never, it's always, people have tried really strong, powerful hairdressers. And they can get it to do something like grown up for a few minutes. But this is why I could never be an airline pilot.
That's why?
No, if you got in an airplane and you saw somebody with my haircut, you'd get right off the plane, right? If it was a person, so.
Also, you'd have to learn how to fly.
That's oh, yeah, crazy. That. But I don't think, nobody checks that, but the haircut they can see.
Right off there. Yeah.
What you're leaving out is the day that Mo Howard saw your head. I'm going to wear my hair like that, too.
I inspired them.
Alan, do you agree with the New York Times that Dave is the funniest man in America?
Yeah, do you?
The New York Times said that?
Apparently. It's wow. On the back of your book.
So this is the curse of my... That was a one reviewer who wasn't even a Times employee, like in 1981, wrote that.
He delivered the Times.
Back in the book. And I have had to, you know, because like, what? Who would even say that? You know what I mean? But I was once on a book tour in England, and they don't think we're funny, the Brits. They think they're funny, and we're not. And so when you go on book tour in England, you go basically... You go to a BBC building and sit in a little studio across from a guy who's way better educated than you and way smarter than you and has that British accent, and he asks you questions, and then you get out and go get in a car and drive around, you know, like for like an hour, and you get back at what appears to be the same studio with a different guy who's just, you know, really smart. And but every single one would start the interview by saying, "Our next guest has been described as the funniest man in America." You know, we'll see about that, you know. So it's painful. I've always hated that quote.
It's hard to
What do you think,
here.
Though, Alan? Is it true? No.
Oh, yeah.
He's the funniest man on this side of the stage. I can give him that. Somebody would like to know, what are your limits of acceptability? This is for either one of you. And pushing the boundaries, certainly... Some of the things in the book push the boundaries a little bit. Perhaps you couldn't have printed them in the Miami Herald, for example.
No, yeah, we have... my character is just a horrible human being. He speaks it horribly, profanely, and has no sensibilities whatsoever. And, you know, I guess when you write that, you're thinking, people will get that we think this guy's, you know, he's a joke. We hope that.
Yeah, I mean, my character is Barney Fife. He's a good citizen. He does everything to perfection. He plays by the rules. So when I created that character and sent it to Dave, it was only natural for him to send back somebody who was the polar opposite. And if you read the book, his character, there's a consistency to it. And he's very, very committed to who this guy is. So if anyone is say, wait a second, there's too much profanity here, that's who the character is. I made sure that my character had some human traits. Okay?
He falls in love with a naked nun.
Well, he fell in love with a naked nun, but it was a moment of weakness, and he felt badly about it, you know?
And he didn't know she was a nun.
He didn't know because
she was naked.
She was naked.
That's a trick nuns play. They're known for that.
Dave, would you share the story? I don't know this story. I'm looking forward to this. Would you share the story of the Oscar Mayer wagon interception with your child?
Oh, yeah, okay. Well, okay, I'll tell it quickly. I have a theory of parenting, which is that your function as a parent is to embarrass your children. Many parents shrink away from that duty, not me. I always felt I embraced it. That's your job, to be hideously embarrassing to your children, just as your parents were hideously embarrassing to you. So anyway, one day I was at the Miami Herald and I got a call from the Oscar Mayer Wiener company saying they're bringing the Oscar Mayer Wiener Mobile to Miami. The Wiener Mobile, everybody's familiar, I'm sure, it's a giant fiberglass hot dog in a bun with a loudspeaker, sits on a truck body. There actually are 6 Wiener Mobiles. A lot of people don't know that. This nation leads the world in Wiener Mobile technology. Although Iran is developing one.
Not for long.
No, we are. Yeah. So they like to get publicity for the Wiener Mobile, so they call me up the Miami Herald and said, we're bringing the Wiener Mobile to Miami. Would you like to drive it for a day? Well, I said, heck yes. I knew exactly what I wanted to do. I wanted to pick my son up at middle school. Because there he is, he's in peer pressure hell. And I'll never forget the moment Rob came out of the school. There's all these moms in their minivans, and looming up behind is a really big hot dog with a loudspeaker going,
Rob Berry, please report to the Wiener Mobile.
And I'll tell you, if a 12-year-old could suffer a heart attack, he would have. And I know what you're thinking. You're thinking, well, Dave, it's a lot of fun for you, but you scarred your child psychologically for life. Yes, but it was worth it. Oh, that's the Wiener Mobile.
Thank you. Politicians, often an easy mark for humor. Who among today, maybe the Republican current crop of candidates, do you find ripest targets, and what is it about politicians that makes them so funny?
I don't know. Where do you start, though? Herman Cain, I was so sad when he dropped out, because he was getting funnier and funnier by the second. Newt is pretty funny. Newt is consistently funny by... they're all pretty funny. Mitt Romney, every now and then, it conveys a human expression, you know? And then his staff has to jump on him, you know, come on, Newt. I mean, Mitt, get back to it. They're all pretty funny. And I think it's that if you think about what the qualities required to run for president of the United States, you have to be just completely insane or an enormous jerk or some combination of the two. Or you would never, ever, ever go through what you have to go through to get that job. So I would love for there to be a candidate who would be honest, and they all say they're going to be honest, who would just say, you know what, I really just want the plane. It'd be just so cool to just have that plane to get, because I really kind of think in the end that's what they want. But that's just me. That's what I would want.
How does writing by yourself compare to collaborating? Alan, you've probably done a lot more collaboration than
me. Oh,
man.
My whole career, I've been really lucky. SNL, Gilda was my collaborator. I created a show called It's Gary Shandling Show. So right. He was my creator. He was my collaborator. Billy, he was... the Lord is my creator. He was my collaborator. Billy Crystal with 700 Sundays. It just goes on and on. So when I write by myself...
You have discovered you have no talent.
Yeah, it was... it's just bare. There's nothing there anymore. And so... It's fun writing by yourself because I can flex muscles I hadn't before, but it's very lonely. It's an unnatural act to sit in a room by yourself and try to be funny, you know? So I look forward to collaboration even just as a way to get away from that solitude. Hence, hello.
Is it easier to have, when doing comedy, to have somebody to bounce things off of?
Absolutely.
Is this funny or not?
Oh, of course. I mean, there's a synergy to it. There's a one in... One equals three thing, and yeah, there's a built-in editing process, you know. So you go, it's somebody waiting to see it, waiting to react to it, and absolutely.
But Dave, most of your career, you did write the Peter Pan books with Ridley, but other than that, you've been a solo act. So
yeah.
How is it for you working with a collaborator?
I really like it. I mean, I won't even try to be funny. I enjoy it. Partly I enjoy just, as Alan said, you have somebody to bounce it off, But also, you don't feel like totally. When you're writing alone, you know, sitting in a room, what immediately goes through your mind, and I think this is true of anybody who writes comedy for a living, is that you're a fraud. You know, you sit there looking at the screen, you go, I'm not funny. I don't have any real skills. I don't have anything useful. I've used up all the jokes there are in the world. That's kind of how you start your day. Sometimes that's how you end your day. You know what I mean?
Sometimes it's the whole entire day.
Yeah. Because you look at the window of people going to work and they have jobs and they know what they're going to do that day, and you feel so envious of those people, but then you think, but then I would have to wear something besides my underwear. So I'm just going to stay here and keep trying to write jokes.
It's
also, you could wear someone else's underwear. I just want to stress that. Anybody getting started in comedy?
Having a background in live TV teaches you a lot of things. One is that nothing is that precious, because an audience is coming in at 11:30 on Saturday night, and if you don't have a script, people turn on NBC, it'll be a black screen. So it teaches you a certain amount of adaptability, which has been really fun in the theater, really fun in also other media. But it also teaches you that in the case that we had with this novel, you adjust, you know. And I remember one time at SNL, Gilda and I had, it was about 2 o'clock on a Friday night, which is Saturday morning, and we were going to a restaurant to work on a thing called Roseanne, Roseanne, and Dana, which we had worked, we created together, and we passed the newsstand with tomorrow's newspapers, and the New York Post, they delivered a pile of the papers, and it said, Mr. Ed dies. Remember the talking horse on TV? This was the headline. Mr. Ed dies.
This is the first time hearing it.
Yeah. I'm just a wealth of all kinds of stuff. So I went to a phone and I called Lauren and I said, listen, got some bad news for you. Mr. Ed died. He said, Alan, it's 2 o'clock in the morning. There better be more to this call. And I said, well, tonight on the show, can we interview Mrs. Ed, the grieving widow? He said, you find a horse. We'll do it on television. So I call the guy in charge of props, you know, because now it's 2:15 in the morning, and I'm a Jew in New York looking for a horse, okay?
On the Sabbath, no less.
What's that?
I said, on the Sabbath, no less.
On the Sabbath, no less. Indeed. So I called the prop guy, and I said, listen, it's my bell. I need a horse for the show tonight. And he goes, what kind? I said, a horse, you know, a regulation horse, you know, big teeth, a tail, you know, a horse. There's Alan, there's Palominos, there's Clydesdales, there's Pintos. What do you want? And I'm gone. All right. Picture Mr. Ed. Who would he choose for a bride? Get me that horse. I go home, I go to sleep, I shower, I come back to the studio, there's a horse there. And for the 7:30 dress rehearsal audience, I wrote a piece. Bill Murray is now the Weekend Update anchor guy. Gilda was going to play the voice of Mrs. Ed. She goes into Don Pardo's booth, and in dress rehearsal, the horse is coming back. And it was really cute what we did, because it was the widow, so we put a black veil and a little hat on the horse. And the horse in the studio was led in, and Bill said, you know, did he suffer much? Oh, no, he went quietly. Yeah, and went, oh, wow, this is going to work. It felt good. So we're going to do it on the air. Something happened to this horse between the time of dress rehearsal and when he saw the red light and he knew that he was on television, because did he suffer much? The horse just started going in circles, just flipped out. We have no script for this. So Gilda's going, oh, I'm so upset, I'm chasing my tail, Bill. And at one point, the horse breaks rank, leaves the studio, goes down a corridor of NBC. Lauren says to a cameraman, follow that horse. And Gilda goes, oh, I'm so upset, I'm going to throw myself out a window, Bill. So it was all good preparation for whatever this guy threw at me. You make an adjustment. Whoa. You go forward.
Like we brought that back. Oh, God.
Woo. I have longer stories.
You knew 37 years later you'd be in this situation. This would come in handy.
Yeah,
it was all building to this moment. Yeah. Of course.
So give
a nice segue.
Yeah, back that was good.
Oh, you know, I had to bring it back. I didn't even know where I was going with this.
Given that, Will there be a Lunatics 2? Could you guys work together, or by the end of this tour?
Absolutely not. No, it's yes. I mean, I really just enjoy. I mean, I don't really care if we even have a book. It's like going on tour with Zweibel. It's been very entertaining. Just watching him try to find the gate at the airport.
He makes it like I'm Rain Man. Yeah, I know that.
Rain Man would be able to find the gate at the airport. Alan doesn't always find the, you know, I you know, like they, where you see the parents with the coiled thing that connects their wrist. That's what I need with
like a little
with,
leash.
With Zweibel. Yeah. Can I? Well, I just want one other thing about Alan on book tour. When you go on book tour, you have to go to many different cities and you have to make a lot of connections. So you pack a small carry-on suitcase because that's all you can really take. When we met for this book tour in New York, Alan had a suitcase that not only could, it did have wheels, but then again, a UPS truck also has wheels. It would not go in the overhead. It was questioned, would the plane be able to take off? And he had a garment bag, but I'm like, what? I said, what did you bring for the book tour? And he said that he brought...
I amongst other things, I bought two bathing suits.
He brought two bathing suits on a book. Now, like you've never, maybe you haven't been in a book tour. You don't appreciate that. But when you go on a book tour, you get a schedule, and it says, like, you know, 7 o'clock, the car will pick you in the morning. It's going to take you this radio station. It's going to take you this thing. There. You go all these interviews all day, and then you're gonna, tonight it's going to take you to an event like this, whatever. What it never says is 3 to 6 p.m., swimming.
I brought a black one and a blue one, depending upon what color socks I was going to be wearing to the pool that day.
Well, they put you up in nice hotels. There could be a pool.
Indeed, you know, absolutely. I thought it was practical.
So it's been very entertaining going on. So I hope we write another book, if for no other reason than to see what he brings.
We'll write another book. We're trying to think of two other characters and another situation, and you know, we haven't really discussed.
We have a title. The Brothers Karamazov. What do you think? They like it. I think they like it. What does Billy Crystal think?
I'll call them afterwards.
Yeah. Yeah. Email them and find out.
Yeah, I will.
Dave, people also would like to know about your column writing days. Do you miss that at all? Do you miss the newspaper world at all? And what was that experience like for you then? And why don't you do it anymore?
Well, I don't really miss it. I did like it. I did it for, really, it was more like 25 years, writing a weekly column. And I don't know. At just some point, I thought, I know I've done this for a long time. I would rather stop doing it before people say, oh, you're still doing, you know. So I still occasionally write for the newspaper. I write a year in review and some other things. And I'll go to the conventions. I'll go to the Olympics and write daily from that. But I don't really miss writing that because I really have been having more fun writing books since then.
How fun was it to write this book? And we'll answer that first. Now, there's a second part to the question.
This really, truly was the most fun I ever had writing a book. It didn't feel like work at all. It really did feel like Alan was saying, I felt like I was, you know, emailing jokes to Alan to make him laugh. That's really what it felt like. And except for at the very end when we realized that we would need an ending. I had to explain to Alan, who's still sending me chapters. I don't think he realizes that the book is actually out.
All right, maybe I am a Rain Man. You're right.
Well, it's incredibly fun to read. It's so funny, and you can feel that on the page when you're reading it. But I wondered, I mean, you've answered some of this in that process. Since you were surprising each other with the chapters, and you're like, oh, I guess we're going to Cuba. Okay, I'll show you Yemen, you know. Was there any rewriting, editing at all when it was done, or did you just kind of go with what you had and say, okay, we need to tie a bow around this at some point?
Occasionally, and I'm not going to name names, one of us would apparently not have really read the other one's chapter.
You know, I have a lot of stuff. I got three kids. I have stuff in my life.
And I would have to send like an email to Alan and say, just like a couple questions on the chapter you just sent me. In the previous chapter, they were in Cuba and they were both male. And now, and a little continuity issue. And one other point. Where this is, I don't know what technically what flaw this would be called, but we were maybe a quarter of the way into the book, and Alan killed all the main characters.
That could be
so
a problem.
I said, maybe you want to read it now.
I didn't think they would die from that height, okay? I really did.
break a leg, you know. So, but other things like that, really little continuity issues, I guess. I don't remember what the question was.
I don't either. I think we're getting close to the time where we're going to take questions from anyone who actually wants to get up and ask them. So if there is anyone who wants to do that, maybe come to that microphone and line up. And as soon as we see bodies there, we'll start calling on them. But in the meantime, I was wondering, actually someone in the audience is wondering, and I'll ask this question. Alan.
Yes.
Alan.
Wow, it's quite a stampede going through that mic, by the way.
Yes. Fortunately, I have a stack here. What don't we know about Billy Crystal and or Larry David that you want to share with the international radio audience? Which can probably be picked up in L.A., by the way.
Larry David, well, Billy is like my closest friend. He and Larry are both my buddies. And Larry David, when we all started out, we all used to sit in the back of the improvisation or whatever club we were in just to watch Larry. He was the comedian's comedian. Back then, I'm talking about 1974, he had hair like, you know, Larry from the Three Stooges, okay? And he had wire-rimmed glasses, and he'd wear a green army fatigue. And he'd get on stage on a Friday night at the Improv, where the crowd was predominantly suburban housewives with blue hair, you know, and they schlepped their husbands with the mattress pants and all that. A pure suburban crowd. Larry would get up, and he'd look at them, and he'd go, first words out of his mouth, you know, I feel very comfortable with you people. In fact, I feel so comfortable, I'm thinking of using the to form of the verb instead of usted. Now, I'm sitting in the back laughing my ass off. A, I thought it was really funny. B, the audience is like an oil painting. They have no idea what they're looking at. And usually what a comic starts off and he hits a roadblock like that, you go in a different direction. Not Larry. He just kept on going. You go, you know, I think a lot of people misuse the to form of the verb. For example, when they stab Caesar. Caesar looked at his friend and said, "A two, Brutus?" And Brutus says, "Caesar, I just stabbed you. If there was ever a time for usted, it's now." And the audience, there's tumbleweed going down the aisles. And Larry going, "Ah, to hell with all of you." And then he would leave. But and we sat back there and we just knew that someday, somehow, no one would predict what happened to him. But we knew that he was a genius.
What about Billy? Anything you want to share about Billy?
Nicest guy in the world. What you see on the stage is what you get. When I wrote 700 Sundays with him, I was honored to do it. I had a write for the characters in his family, most of whom I never met. But for me to write for a Long Island Jewish family is not really a stretch, you know. So he's got a real big heart, and there's no secrets there. I can't tell you anything you don't know. He's a wonderful family man. He's been married to Janice for 40 or 41 years. Got a couple of kids, about three grandchildren. He's great.
You know, Woody Allen started out writing jokes for local newspapers, then comedians, and you mentioned that you wrote for Borscht Belt Comics. Is that avenue still open? Are there comics that people write for like that? Can people get started writing jokes like that?
That's a good question.
TV? Because, I mean, that's...
TV?
Like Leno, Letterman, John...
They all have staffs, but they all have big
staffs,
you know.
Right,
but if you're talking about starting out, most comics write their own stuff, but they buddy up with somebody. And that's what Larry did with Jerry, for example. They were both starving in the clubs. They took to each other. He wrote for Jerry, and when Jerry got this pilot, he said, "Come on, Larry, write it with me."
And can you teach somebody to be funny, to write comedy? Is it either they have it or they don't, or can you? People ask me sometimes about teaching writing, and I have a very hard time explaining how to write or how to teach writing. What about comedy? What about being funny?
No.
Either you have it or you don't. Can't
I agree.
Be taught.
No. And you don't.
No. I fed you the line.
Yeah, thank you. No, I don't believe you can teach people to be funny. I mean, people can hone it, you know, and get better at writing it and better at delivering it, but I don't think... anybody's got no sense of humor is going to get one. Do you?
We have a guy.
Look, someone wants to ask a question.
This is so exciting.
Wow.
The youngest member of our studio audience.
Yeah.
has somehow made it to the standing microphone and would like to ask a question. Sir?
Are we going to have to know, like, about modern things?
Oh, wait,
things?
I'm sorry. Wait, I have to say one thing. Oh. Please keep your questions short and to the point, although we may make an exception.
What point?
And make sure there are questions and not statements or comments. With that, the floor is yours, sir.
Thank you. Before my question, I do have a very quick statement. It's not like there's a line. I mean, no.
See, he's funny.
He's funny. He's very funny.
Can't teach that. You cannot teach that.
Cannot be taught. No.
Did anybody teach you that? No.
Actually, Dave, I want to thank you, because when I was in high school, my cousin gave me one of your books, Dave Barry Talks Back, and I read it. I hadn't read anything like it before. I was just, you know, sitting on the couch on my own, laughing out loud. And I went off to college a couple years later, and I thought, I want to try this. So for 4 years in college, I was at USC in Los Angeles. I wrote a weekly humor column in a similar style to yours. So I ended up writing 100 of these just every week, writing every night.
And you failed, you flunked out. And you're homeless now.
Now I'm homeless, yeah. But sincerely, it was one of the most rewarding experiences I've ever done, and so I want to thank you for inspiring me to do that.
Is that the statement or the question?
That's the statement, yes. No, the question also for Dave is in transitioning...
He's so much more a fan of mine than he is.
I know.
If anybody got any questions about deli, I can tell you. Sliced meat, I'm here for you.
This is a great kid. I love this kid.
Yeah.
He's a great questioner.
I hate him. There's Hitler, Bin Laden, and this kid, okay?
I think you... Dave, you were right about that head comment.
God. Thank you. Dave, and you're standing pretty far away. Trust me. You were this close. Yeah.
No, my question is, in transitioning from writing your short-form humor to your long-form narratives, what was the biggest challenge with that?
Just being brave enough to try it. I mean, I was in my 40s before I even tried to write a novel, and up to that point I kept saying, no, I don't think I could do that because I don't know how to do it. And, you know, it turns out, I think if you read a lot and you have reasonable, you can sort of figure out what you're supposed to do. But it's the hard part is, the difference is, novels, long form, you need some kind of plot.
Is that word again?
Except in our situation. And you know, when I wrote a humor column, I never worried about a structure of any organization of any kind, because I had no point whatsoever, as was pretty clear if you read them.
Thanks very much.
You're welcome.
Yep. Thank you.
What a great young man.
And now we have another gentleman. Sir, your question?
I don't have a statement.
I'm sorry, you'll have to sit down.
No, my question is...
That was insane. That actually was a statement.
That was a statement.
Yeah, it was.
Okay. My question to both of you is, Dave, your books have such a depth and breadth of topics, and Alan, Saturday Night Live is just a phenomenal thing in terms of the topics and the questions and the jokes you come up with. How do you guys get all these ideas? Where do they come from? It's just... If you can comment on that, I'd appreciate it.
We have no useful skills. I mean that. I'm dead serious. Ellen and I have talked about this. We never...
I don't know how to scan. If I was, like, at the checkout thing, all right, and you know, the code got a little, you know, crinkled, I couldn't do that thing.
So, like, whatever other mental energy that people who are actually making useful products in the world... focus on that or doing things that people actually need. We have spent our entire lives trying to amuse ourselves. And so that's all we know how to do. So we're better at it than people who have real jobs. Wouldn't you say that's...
Look, I think that's absolutely right, because, you know, if you want to feed your family, let's say, you have to discipline yourself. I also think that there's a way of looking at the world. Okay, so you can find, look, once again, my friend Larry David will take a little morsel and make a whole meal out of it. So it's a matter of being looking at the world with a certain kind of attitude.
But there are a lot of people who are funny and you have good sense of humor, but they get sidetracked into productive work.
Thank you.
We don't let that happen.
No.
Well, I'm afraid that we are out of time, as hard as that is to believe.
No.
you.
I don't even think we can ask a final question because the answer would take us past our time.
Right.
I'd have to bring the gavel
down. Talking about Saturday Night.
And the gavel
by the way,
break
I have
on
a
Alan's
song.
Head. No, go ahead. Do you have a song? Yeah, okay. So our thanks to Dave Barry and Alan Zweibel, humorists, as we've learned, and authors of the new book, Lunatics. This program has been part of the Commonwealth Club's Good Lit series, underwritten by the Bernard Osher Foundation. We also thank our audiences here and on radio, television, and the Internet. We also want to remind everybody here in the room that copies of the book Lunatics are on sale in the lobby, and our speakers will be pleased to sign them immediately following the program and desperately ask you to please buy a copy. You'll sign it one more. Okay.
Anyone have a pen?
We therefore appreciate your allowing them to make their way to the lobby as quickly as possible. Don't tackle them or anything like that. I'm Doug Sovereign, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.
Good job, Doug.
Thanks, Doug.
Good. 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 Good.